I do not believe in punishing performance, so we are going to start on time. You guys are here, and we're starting. You're important. I'm Robert McClure. I'm with Investigate West in Seattle, small nonprofit journalism studio that does environment, public health, social justice stories, and places them in other media. We have here today a great panel of people who have been doing this longer than I have, and so I'm here to learn, as I think a lot of you are, what's going on with nonprofit journalism. I want to mention just right off the bat that nonprofit journalism is not by any means new. In fact, the Associated Press was founded, I think, in 1846 or something like that. Christian Science Monitor around 1920, something. It goes on. There's many nonprofit journalism that have been around a long time. So it's a trend. It's not a new trend, though. And we're going to, because typically SEJ panels, we run out of time for questions, we're going to sort of dispense with opening statements and just go straight to questions and answers. And I'm going to ask a couple of questions, moderator's prerogative. And the first one would be to ask folks to please introduce themselves and tell us a little bit about their nonprofit journalism outlet and what they and who they are and what they're doing. We're going to start with Jason Begay, who is the brand new executive director of ResNet here in Missoula.
Hi. Can you hear me okay? I'm Jason Begay. I am from the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico. I spent the past 6 years covering tribal government for the Navajo Times and started here at the University of Montana as an assistant professor and directing ResNet in August. ResNetNews.org is a news website that was designed as a mentorship project to get Native American kids off of Indian reservations and inspire some kind of civic journalism type spirit into them and get them writing and taking pictures for the website. The goal when it started was to get kids into mainstream newsrooms eventually. In the 8 years that the site has been running, we're seeing that bigger successes are getting kids into tribal newspaper newsrooms. I think that's where I'm going to start focusing on as I continue with the project. The project is has been funded by grant monies, mostly from the big names, Gannett Foundation. I think we had something from Knight and Excellence in Ethics in the News. Most of those have run out, so it's up to me to find some new funding sources in the next year or so.
A lot of that going around.
Yeah, I'm Jody Peterson. I'm the managing editor of High Country News. And for those of you that haven't heard of High Country News, we are a nonprofit, obviously, news organization that's been around for 40 years now. We have a news magazine that comes out 22 times a year. We have a website at hcn.org, and we also have a syndicated opinion column service. We have about 25,000 readers of the print magazine, about 50,000 visitors to the website each month. And we cover natural resource, environment, cultural and social issues in the 11 western states. We're based in western Colorado in a little tiny town called Paonia. We have a staff of roughly 25. It's actually because of SEJ that I'm at High Country News now. I spent my early career, 16 years working in the computer industry in high tech as a technical writer and editor, and around 2003 decided I really couldn't stand working for a corporation anymore and needed to be doing something different, and what I really wanted to do was write about environmental issues. And I went to SEJ in Baltimore and talked to everybody that I could there and met Bill Allen, whom some of you may know, who at the time was a senior fellow with IJNR, and I told him what I wanted to be doing, and he said, "You need to be working for High Country News." And so I make a long story short, I wound up getting an internship there, and then in 2004 got a job offer 6 months later, and I've been there ever since, and it's been fantastic. So it's really exciting to be here now. High Country News operates with a budget of close to $2 million a year, and we have been around long enough that we're raising that through a lot of different sources. We have about 35% of that comes from subscriptions. About another 25-30% that comes directly from reader donations, another 25% from grants, and 10% or less from advertising. I think that all adds up to 100, but you know, the percentages of each shift from year to year. But we're really hoping to eventually transition to a model where grants are less and less important to us. And even right now, if we were to lose all our grant funding, we could probably scale back and still survive. So I guess I'll quit talking and...
Here, come on.
Oh, thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm Marla Cohn, Editor-in-Chief of Environmental Health News. And most people at SEJ probably know me as a newspaper reporter, which I have always called myself, and still I have to stop myself from calling. But I decided 2 years ago to just sort of jump that sinking ship of the LA Times, and had the opportunity to start up a venture at Environmental Health News. Environmental Health News has aggregated environmental news since 2002. It used to be my home page because it was so helpful in telling me around the world what reporters were writing about. And the difference of most aggregation is that they're all hand-read. I mean, every single story that goes on our page is read and ranked, and we decide what deserves our front page, and that's 200 to 300 stories a day. So it's a very large staff of researchers and editors that deal with that. And in 2 years, we decided to expand to producing our own content, and that's why I was hired to sort of help newspapers and other mass media fill the void of all the departing staff. So since then, we've been producing our own content. Our first year, there were about 50 stories that we wrote that no media was covering. Environmental health stories are particularly hard to cover. There's a lot of scientific information and a lot of back and forth and really hard judgment calls on how not to be alarmist but still get your point across. So in these 2 years, we've produced a large number of stories. We have a sister site, The Daily Climate, run by Douglas Fisher, that does the same thing for climate stories. And I've been able to hire people like Robert, who I haven't paid you yet, but he's in the middle of doing a story for me. And you might know Jane Kay from the San Francisco Chronicle. She has, like me, about 30 years of newspaper experience. So when we team together on a story, that's 60 years of environmental journalism experience, which is really scary to think about. So it's really fun to hire reporters like this and to do some great stories that just would not be covered anywhere else, and to give a chance to some reporters who voluntarily left newspapers or were laid off newspapers or their newspapers closed. So that's sort of our mandate, and we write about areas that most reporters don't have the time or the inclination to write about anymore. Like, I didn't assign a single oil spill story because I could tell from our aggregation that that's where all the environmental reporters from around the world seem to be. So we go back, we focus on environmental chemicals and pollution and air quality, anything that can affect human health or ecological health. And our budget is about $1.5 million a year. We took a little bit of a hit last year, lost one funder, but gained another one. So our publisher has been very successful at keeping us alive and hoping to expand with actually a reporting staff is my goal.
That's a good segue. You were starting to talk about some of the things that Environmental Health News does that others don't. So I'm going to ask each of the panelists, and we'll forgive Jason. He's really like 2 weeks on the job now. So, but he'll tell us what he hopes to do that that for-profit media would not do. But we're going to go in the opposite order. Talk to me a little bit about some of the stories that you are really proud of that you've done that wouldn't have gotten done otherwise.
You go ahead.
Me?
You start first, Marla.
Okay. Well, one of them we can show. Can you
sure.
Scroll down a little bit on there?
Sure. Which one are we looking for?
This is
You can drive.
I don't know how to use your phone.
Oh, here. Yeah. Okay.
How do I move down?
Oh, shoot. Sorry.
The person that I should know.
That's okay.
More news.
Okay.
Sorry, everybody.
Sorry.
I want to.
This one here.
Okay.
Good.
This is an example of a story. Mm-hmm. You could probably go down a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
This is an example of a story that Jane Kay did for us about a little community in Central California that wasn't getting any attention. There's a huge cheese factory there, like one of the world's largest cheese factories, that for decades has been dumping some waste that causes water quality problems. And it's in an area that there's hardly any environmental writers left in the Central Valley of California. It's a tiny little community. And what grabbed me about this story is that it's a big environmental justice issue, but it's not a company that came in and sort of took over a town and destroyed it, because these were the town's founders that owned this company. And these people here are related to the company owners, but their water is contaminated, and they've been sort of fighting within their own family. And it's just sort of a great rural America story about water pollution and how they couldn't use their water wells anymore, and how the state had been, you know, trying to deal with the company and getting sort of the runaround, and just decades of problems there. And so this was an example of, I think, a really strong environmental justice story that nobody was covering. In this story, the irony is that Jane took a buyout from the San Francisco Chronicle, and nobody has filled her shoes, but we gave this story to the Chronicle, and they ran it on their front page on a Sunday a couple of weeks ago. So the Chronicle readers could again enjoy Jane Kay's stories, you know, because we're not here to make money, so we just offer the stories for free to whatever the local paper might be. So that's an example of a story we're particularly proud of.
Jody?
Okay, I'll just mention a couple of stories from this past year that we're particularly proud of. And, you know, being a nonprofit, obviously we're not beholden to advertisers, and so we have a lot of intellectual freedom in what we choose to cover. And then one thing that we've been interested in a lot over the years is conditions for workers in various industries. Our senior editor, Ray Ring, who's sitting in the back of the room there, did a story for us a couple of years ago about the conditions in the oil and gas fields. It's called Disposable Workers of the Oil and Gas Fields, and did a really extensive investigative project that took him, I think, at least 6 to 9 months looking at what was going on in that industry and the conditions that workers faced, and the how OSHA and the federal government was, you know, just giving companies a real light slap on the wrist, you know, even though they were a very high level of injuries and deaths being caused to workers in the energy industry. And that one won a Hillman Prize. Then we also did an investigation this past year that Rebecca Claren, who's one of our contributing editors, did for us on looking at conditions in the dairy industry and what workers face in that and the kinds of injuries that they suffer on the job there. That also won a Hillman. And we've done a lot of those big investigative projects over the years, and we've also, you know, we have areas that we feel are our pillars, that are very much our core coverage, and that's, you know, in addition to the, you know, the worker conditions that I mentioned, those, you know, we spend a lot of time covering energy and water use in the West, public lands, wildlife, and we also have climate change, and then we've also branched out and done some more social coverage and cultural coverage. So in 2005 we did a story that we still get a lot of comments on called Gangs of Zion, which you know, was kind of a surprise to a lot of our readers. You know, it was a story about Polynesians who had come to Salt Lake City with the Mormon Church, and then the gang culture that had kind of developed there, you know, as they were sort of adrift in a new land and, you know, facing this, trying to assimilate into another culture, and they had terrible problems with gangs. So we wrote a story about that and really surprised a lot of our readers, who thought, what the heck is High Country News doing, you know, covering this social issue? But, you know, the West is about a lot of things. It's not just the environment and the natural resources. And because we do that solid pillar coverage of the topics that people look to us for, you know, the energy production and mining and grazing and logging, and, you know, occasionally we can branch out and, you know, kind of give people something unexpected, which is something that we always are striving to do with our coverage and the angles that we take. We also took a look at the Mormon Church's influence on Prop 8, California, on gay marriage, which again was an issue that people were surprised to see in High Country News, and we lost some subscribers over it, but we feel like it's important for us to take that broader look and really dig into and analyze what's going on culturally in the West as well as with its natural resources.
Jason? Tell us what you hope to do.
What I hope to do. We're a pretty small operation. Like I said, we work mostly with students. And the end goal, I would hope, is to, like I said earlier, is to inspire some kind of awareness in younger people in tribal government, and very particularly tribal government. As I'm sure you all know, it's barely underrepresented in mainstream newsrooms. But every reservation I've been on, there's always this really great group of college kids who are really into what's going on. I want to make a difference, but nobody really wants to write about it because they don't think they can, or they're deterred by a blank computer screen sometimes. And so what I found out in the past month I've been here is that everybody wants a mentor. If they're going to write, they want someone who's going to be with them and who's going to show them how to do it. And so my goal is to create like some sort of network with kids in reservation, pairing them up with a reporter at a nearby newspaper, and hoping we can work something out as far as getting stories done, getting blogs done. So that's actually probably one of the first things that I'm going to be working on in the next couple months.
Okay, I've been doing this, by the way, just about a year and a half, and a lot of things happened along the way that I really didn't expect, and so I'm going to ask the panelists to talk about bumps in the road that face nonprofit journalism. My personal advice is if you're going to do something like this, just remember that everything takes a lot longer than you thought it would. It feels like you're walking through maple syrup sometimes. So what advice would you have for folks, and what should they be prepared for in terms of bumps in the road? Any order is fine. Who wants to go first?
I guess I would echo that advice in spades, that everything takes way, way longer than you think it ought to or that you think it should. High Country News has been around for 40 years, and we didn't start life as a nonprofit. We kind of stumbled into it accidentally. We were founded by a rancher who wanted to communicate to other people about what he saw as environmental issues in Wyoming, and he bought a little weekly newspaper that was covering camping news, and then he started kind of branching out and writing about environmental issues, and as he did that, he found that all of his advertisers went away. So then he decided the way to approach this was to make it a nonprofit. But that was back in 1970, and he ran it as a nonprofit for a couple of years, and then it almost folded. Without a real, strong source of funding, it was really, really difficult. He was basically wound up selling his ranch and depleting his personal savings to keep it going. And then Tom Bell finally decided that he could no longer keep up with the strain of it, and turned it over to a couple of his staffers, and they struggled financially for many years. And then there was a terrible car accident that took the life of one staffer and injured several others, and nobody had insurance. And once again, as had happened the first, I forgot a part of the story, sorry, the first time that there was a real severe financial crisis with High Country News back in the early 70s, the founder, Tom Bell, basically told his readers, we're going to be going out of business, we can't do this. And the reader outpouring to sustain it was tremendous. It was just people sent money, sent checks, sent notes saying, don't you dare go out of business, got it back on financial footing. Then there was the accident, and that really set HCN back again. But again, there was a big outpouring from readers who sent in something like $35,000 to cover medical bills and get all the staff insurance. And so it's been this, growing from this, years and years of financial struggle, we've built up, to 25,000 readers today, and they're still incredibly dedicated, and they still rally to our aid. We had our 40th anniversary this this past year and brought in many more dollars, tens of thousands more dollars than we'd expected from readers who are still, you know, very much committed to what we do and supporting us and sustaining us. But, you know, it's taken us a really, really, really long time to get there. So it's it's just, you know, and building up that reader community. I mean, it's, yeah, it's doing something, you know, providing those readers something that they don't get anywhere else. It's, you know, a viewpoint on the West. It's considering the West as a region. It's, you know, a deeper level of analysis and thought. You know, it's just, people tell us over and over again that what they value about High Country News is information that they're just not going to find anywhere else. And I think that's kind of important to keep in mind for other nonprofit institutions today is, you know, what can you do that is unique that your readers are going to value and keep coming back to you for?
Well, one of my biggest goals has been to not just publish our stories on our site and on Daily Climate site, but to provide them to newspapers in particular and other print sources. And it's there's been a lot more obstacles than I ever imagined. I thought it might be because they were suspicious of foundation-funded journalism or something like that, but it doesn't seem to be that because they realize the level of experience that I have and my staff has. So it's not a question of the quality of the journalism, but the newspapers just are, and I know this after spending so many decades there, there's just walls up between departments and everything else, and something like this just doesn't fit their model. And it's like, okay, well, if I accept really good journalism from somewhere else, then aren't they going to question why I really need all these reporters? And so it's like, it's really kind of a crazy philosophy. I mean, that cheese plant story we offered to the closest urban paper in the area, and they said, well, we don't have a projects editor right now, we don't have anybody to deal with it, and we don't know what to do with it. It's a really good story. And they admitted they didn't have the staff to recreate the story, they hadn't heard of it. And it's like, so finally I just sort of gave up on them, and it was really kind of sad. And so I went to the San Francisco Chronicle, which the Metro editor was very receptive. And so the Chronicle got the story, and the Sacramento Bee didn't. And I would just wonder what they would do when they opened up the Chronicle and said, well, that's a story our readers didn't get. I would think that would have been their reaction. But it was just sort of confusion and, you know, I know with the LA Times, it's like, okay, we're trying to recreate our green page. They have a really pretty awful green page right now with stuff on there that I think is just automatically put on if it has the word environment on it, so you'll find something ridiculous that has nothing to do with it. And so until they figure out in their business model how they can use people like us, who are really just up there to help, to provide stories and to get a wider audience. We don't charge for our stories. We're trying to create a wire service. But we do find that there's only a handful of newspapers that have been willing to work with us and accept it. And I think ProPublica has had the same kind of obstacles. I've talked to them, and they say that it's a horrific process of going through the editing of their stories sometimes with newspapers.
Yeah.
So that's my biggest obstacle right now, is that type of the walls up.
I just have to jump in here because Investigate West, we're covering Cascadia, and so we're very much a regional group, and Rita Hibbert, who's our executive director, is the person who's in charge of going out and doing exactly what you're talking about. And we've had really great acceptance by almost everybody, but there's one newspaper editor, I won't say exactly which newspaper, but Rita sends in this very nice email explaining who we are and what we're going to be doing, and the guy read it. I mean, it was literally like a minute and 10 seconds. He sent back, "No thanks." So we're working on it though. We're still working on it. No, we're not giving up.
You think it's just sort of an old-fashioned mentality? It's like, if it's not by my staff, I don't want it?
I guess. But I have to say, we've had a lot of acceptance, though. But there are definitely those folks out there.
Yeah, we've had very good success. I mean, we've only been doing this for less than 2 years.
Yeah.
And I think that just the fact that large newspapers have run our stuff is pretty good. But it is sort of frustrating that it's not happening more often.
Jason, again, an unfair question since you've been on the job for about 2 weeks. Yeah, but what bumps in the road have you hit?
Well, the past 6 weeks, if I say funding, is that too obvious? I'm trying to find funders, like I said, funding has dried out. But more specifically, as I've been looking, the types of funders have become really important in a way that I didn't quite think of before. I mean, everybody has these ideas of going to tribal governments to ask for money to fund a project, or the particularly casino-rich tribes. But then comes the question of, I mean, these are the tribes that we hope to cover at some point when we are going in, and it's become a question of whether we really want this money and under what price, because they're very media shy in the first place, and if they did give us money, who's to say what would happen down the line? So that's been something I've been having a lot of discussions about with a lot of people. And that was an unforeseen bump in the road.
Okay. Just to raise your hand. Who else here works at a nonprofit journalism institute? Okay, good. So we got some people in the audience. Those are the questions that I wanted to ask. It's now time for you guys to ask questions. And also, if you'd like to share an experience that you've had, or something that you think might help people in the room from your experience, we're all here at SEJ to help each other. That's what it's all about. So. If you have questions or comments, I think we have a room where people can hear what people are saying. But if you'd like to, you can come down here and use this mic, or you can just
stand up.
Just stand up. I think people will be able to hear you, and so you can ask questions or share experiences. We're all here to learn from each other. So, what I do want you to do is identify yourself by name and your outlet, and then we would for blue badges first, as we say, SEJ members first. But we have some time here, and that was the whole point of getting right into this. We have about 45 minutes, so who's first? Karen.
I got some. I'll come to the mic.
Sure.
My name is Karen Schaefer. I'm now a freelance independent radio reporter or producer in Northern Ohio. And for years we had a great resource in Great Lakes. It was called initially the Great Lakes Radio Consortium. It was a public radio consortium of primarily free folks based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But they brought in a lot of freelancers and did some great training in the environment, some great training of writing and how to approach storytelling on radio. Unfortunately, this summer, they had to close up shop. They expanded to try and create a national presence, and they just couldn't find the funding to do that. And I now see an opportunity for myself. There's a hole in environmental journalism in my neck of the woods. And I'm thinking about exploring it, but obviously I don't want to do the same thing. I have to find a different angle and a different take on how I approach things. And whether I start small, you know, it's just me and then I grow, or whether it's just an online presence. But my object is going to try and create programming that public radio stations would carry, but also programming that, you know, the public has access to. And I'd appreciate any advice from this panel or anyone else in the room who has any thoughts.
Everybody's looking at Jody.
And it's like the radio world is out of my realm, so yeah. I don't even know if you would reach those. You'd have those kind of barriers like we have in the print world. I would imagine you still would.
Yeah,
actually, I'm Beth Park. I have a question for Marla that actually will maybe answer just distribution systems of your content. And I know that your output and the Daily Climate have used a new news exchange program. It's under the Publish2.com system. Are you familiar with
it?
Not very. Douglas
yeah,
is
okay.
In
the
charge.
The question is whether there's a distribution network that is good at getting out.
That can support it, because if you're producing great work, then the next question is, well, how do you distribute it?
Yeah.
And people that are doing this, I guess I'm interested in how you get it out, other than the retail sale of calling up the newspaper editor. Is there a, because I know this outfit called the News Exchange, it's under a startup called Publish2.com. And maybe if you want to get it up.
Okay, yeah, Publish2.com.
Like the CEO said he wants to disrupt the Associated Press, not destroy it, but give another way that people can distribute content to print outlets, I think, but it's a way, and I know that some of the daily climate work has gone out through that system, the News Exchange. But I just wanted to bring it up and wondered if anybody had experience with it could talk about it. But it might help. I bring it up because I think if you produce something, you need a way to distribute it. And that's a big piece of it. Because is it retail to the individual public audience, or is it wholesale to other news organizations?
Yeah, I guess I'm going to ask people to come up and use the mic then.
Okay.
But the point was made that you know that the retail sale of these things is tremendously time consuming. And I will vouch for that for Investigate West. It's really a lot of what we end up doing is dealing with individual editors. Published News Exchange. I should also say that our original plan was that we were going to be a syndicate. And so we would have people paying us a certain amount every month, and then we would send them something, you know, on a regular basis. We still hope to get there, but the retail sale is the only way we've found. I'm glad you mentioned this published too, Beth. Thank you very much. Any other thoughts about that distribution?
It's kind of a little bit out of my realm of experience, but with High Country News, we did actually have a radio program for several years, Radio High Country News. And it was distributed to a lot of different public radio stations, but it went under about 5 years ago just because we found it it was stretching us too thin to try to do that and the magazine. And we really needed to kind of focus our resources in one area rather than having kind of a separate branch which was doing its own reporting and so on. And we're kind of coming back into the radio realm very, very... on a very, very small scale now. We've been doing podcasts, basically interviews with editors and sources about a particular story or a hot issue or something. And we've made arrangements with just a couple of local stations to pick those up. We put them on iTunes, and we hope in the next year to start figuring out how to get those out more broadly. So we're going to be kind of trying to figure out the distribution thing on radio ourselves, so I wish I had some good advice about that, but...
Have you tried PRX?
I don't know.
What is PRX? Public Radio Exchange.
Yeah, I don't
know. What is that, Karen?
Well, let me think about it. PRX is something, it's a public radio exchange, and it is a distribution system. I'm unsure whether I want to use it. What it does, basically, it's used by public radio stations, independent producers, and the public. And it's a nonprofit. I don't know how they fund themselves, but basically, a producer or a radio station may put a story up on their website. If the story is picked up by another public radio station, and it's an independent producer who creates it, they get a royalty. It's not much of a royalty, but it's a way at least of sharing information and getting some feedback, not only from producers and editors, but also from the general public, people who get to consume this news. So that's one system I know of.
Yellow badge.
Yellow badge, come on up. No, there's no blue badges there yet. Oh, Jane's coming up. Okay.
I'm Jane Braxton Little. I'm an independent writer from the far northern Sierra, northeastern California. And in interest of full disclosure, I've been writing for High Country News for years. I won't say how many, because I don't remember. My question has to do with finances and the finances that trickle down from you to the likes of us, the creators. I don't think any of us that write for independent outlets expect megabucks, but I'm interested in hearing your thoughts about what you can provide to those of us that write for you in lieu of the big bucks. What kind of perks?
Yeah, we wish we could provide the big bucks or even, mini bucks. But being a nonprofit outlet, we pay a heck of a lot less than most for-profit or commercial magazines can do. But we can't make freelancers rich. We can offer them something that... is often difficult to find these days, which is the space to really explore a topic, the word count to really delve into something more deeply and explore it more fully. And that's something what I hear from freelancers is that they don't often get that opportunity to, you know, really explore a topic and write in the way that they want to write. We allow a great deal of intellectual freedom to our freelancers, and we like to think that we provide a pretty sane editing process, where, you know, we work closely with the writers, but really try very hard to, you know, allow them to preserve their own voice and, you know, write the story in the way that they want to write it, and not be heavy-handed and intrusive in the editing process. So it's, yeah, it doesn't pay much money, but it does allow writers a little chance to do the kind of writing that they really want to do, and explore topics that maybe other magazines really, you know, wouldn't really even want to get into.
Hey, Jason, could you address that for ResNet? You don't pay, but you offer something very special. Right?
Actually, we do pay. Okay. We pay per story. We also, like you said, are going to focus more on providing mentorship, which helps because we're dealing mostly with students, either myself or I'm developing a pretty close network of former colleagues who are willing to work with us and the students in helping them learn how to craft a story and eventually get them some kind of internships as they go along. Like I said, the previous goal of the site was get them into mainstream newsrooms. I think we're not going to abandon that, but we are going to start focusing a lot more on tribal newspapers. And working with them and seeing what they can do to help us mentor any students we have from their area.
Actually, if you don't mind, I want to add one other thing to my answer, which is one thing that I've heard a lot of our freelancers say is that they really appreciate having the opportunity to contribute to a magazine that has a mission, you know, that's trying to kind of do some good in the world and inform people, and so that's, you know, that's a lot of our freelancers say, well, you know, I do this other writing for these other magazines and they pay $2 a word, and, you know, but I don't really, you know, it's just kind of it's just paying the bills. But this is work that I do because I really love to do it. And so it, you know, provides kind of that sense of satisfaction in contributing to something larger.
Well, I have to say we pay very well, which is, it surprises people. Because Douglas and I don't want to be cheapskates.
No, I'm not calling you a cheapskate. That's not what I'm saying.
Because I've seen things on the listserv where people say they're being paid $50 a column, and I'm going, oh, my God. I mean, you know, you might as well go flip signs for McDonald's or something. I mean, that's really awful that it's slave labor. So we pay very well, but in return, we expect very high-quality journalism, like you would expect at a large, major newspaper. The piece that Jane just wrote was 3,500 words. And it was a process of just refining that story and doing the investigative work and the writing styles. Just it was a terrific piece. It was a magazine-style piece. And so we pay magazine-style rates, which is unusual out there, I know. And so Douglas at Daily Climate and me at Environmental Health News, we're looking for freelancers around the country. Like right now I need somebody in Hawaii for a story I want to do, you know, and we pay pretty well for those stories.
So can you be specific? How well do you pay?
Well, I'd rather not, because it depends on the story and the experience of the writer. And
can you give us a ballpark range?
I don't know. I really better not. Douglas will tell me if I say anything. Okay. So
that's a no. That's a no.
I guess a no comment, which is the only no comment you'll ever hear from me, right, Beth? I mean, I'm not
because we're on the
no comment type.
Okay, next person, and we do want to get to the yellow badge, so let's move through these.
Hi, my name is James Fahn. I'm the director of the Earth Journalism Network. We're a nonprofit media development agency. We have a slightly different model. We're not a news agency ourselves. What we do is we support journalists working for other media outlets through trainings, fellowships, small grants, workshops, whatever. And you may not have heard of us because we mostly have worked overseas in developing countries, and we've been pretty successful there. I recently moved back to the U.S., and we're hoping to do more work in the U.S., hopefully with SEJ as a partner as well. We get, right now we get all of our funding from private foundations, individuals, and from European governments. But we are starting to dabble or explore the idea of getting funding from corporations, which is obviously, you know, something we're all probably a little leery of. And so I'd like to hear if anyone's had experience doing that, whether it's, you know, in the form of a grant or even advertising. Obviously, there are limits we place on this. We won't accept money from oil companies or other extractive industries, probably chemical companies we won't accept. Right now, for instance, we're talking to a Silicon Valley tech firm. They maybe provide us with equipment or software. But maybe in the future, the relationship will deepen and there'll be exchange of money and so on. So I'd just like to hear anyone else's experience. And I'd like to hear from journalists whether this would be a turnoff for you. If the money was coming from a private corporation, and obviously you're not, it's not affecting what you report, then, you know, there is that firewall, of course. Does that, would that make you feel less inclined to work under that, those conditions?
So the question, I think, is whether we would, if I got this right, whether we would not want to work for corporations, the corporations are paying for it. Is that basically what we're talking about?
Corporate support.
Yeah.
Would you work for, you know, a nonprofit agency, for a news agency, do your reporting? You know, I guess it's not so different from what's happening now. I mean, advertising pays for media as it is, but if you knew that, you know, you were being offered a training workshop or a fellowship, and you knew the money was coming from a private corporation, would that make you hesitate? And again, if any other nonprofit media organizations have had experience working with money from a private corporation, I'd be interested to hear that.
Well, that's an interesting question, whether we would... So the training paid for by a private corporation, would you do that or not? I haven't really had that opportunity to think about it. Any thoughts on the panel here, or in the audience?
We don't get any money directly from corporations, and we get it from various foundations, some of which actually are funded, you know, from the wealth of corporations. For example, the Packard Foundation. I always love the irony that what enabled me to quit Hewlett Packard and go to work for Huffington News was a grant from the Packard Foundation. But that said, you know, those are philanthropic arm, you know, organizations that don't really, you know, they don't have anything to do with the corporations themselves. You know, the only thing we get from corporations is advertising and then occasionally donations of merchandise that, you know, we had donations of various pieces of outdoor gear and other kind of swag that we used as enticements for our 40th anniversary fund drive. But we don't have any direct relationship with corporations, and I don't foresee us doing that. We did get an unsolicited gift from the Walton Foundation, which is, you know, Walmart, which kind of made us hesitate for a while about whether we should really take that or not. This was before I actually started High Country News. And finally, the consensus on the editorial staff was, hell yes, we'll take that money and we'll do some good with it.
Do some greenwashing stories, yes.
And I should say our very first grant came from a local foundation whose roots were originally in the timber business. But Karen, you?
I've got a quick response.
Sure, quick response to his question. Go ahead.
Real quickly, obviously, that's the public radio model. But only in the sense of something like corporate sponsorship. However, we did, in a station I worked for, have a bit of a dilemma, and we eventually turned the money down, kind of at my insistence. We were being offered a U.S. EPA education grant to produce a series of stories, or just simply to fund general environmental reporting. And I said, wait a minute, that's a conflict of interest, because almost every story I write involves the U.S. EPA, and I can't be taking money from them that's paying my salary, and at the same time writing about them. So that's something to consider for you.
Okay, next question.
Well, I was going to say we don't take any corporate money or government money or interest group money. It's all foundations. And I don't see any change at this point.
My name is John Anthony, Communications Director for Energy and Climate with the United Nations Foundation.
organization. I have a two-part question. One is myself, and I think a small sample size of my colleagues who work in media relations outreach, I think have a patchwork understanding at best of the entities around the country that are forming, the Texas Tribune, Investigate West, ProPublica, and an entity in San Diego. Has there been any effort to create an association of sorts of nonprofit journalism? And if so, where? What is the status of that? And second part of the question is, do you have a formal presence at events such as environmental grant makers, association conferences, whatnot, just to better tap into those resources?
I'm going to actually take that one myself. A lot of the new organizations, not ProPublica, but many of the new ones that sprung up, and there's a surprising number, are members of something called the Investigative News Network. And we've recently hired an executive director who actually came out of .com type journalism. But that's what we figured we needed, was somebody who really knew the business part of it. So there's something called the Investigative News Network. I'll pull it up here in a minute. So we are trying to help each other understand some of the basic business things that we need to do to make ourselves go. But we are also cooperating on some reporting projects, John. And the second part of your question, I'm sorry, refresh me. What's the second part of your question?
The second part is whether or not you have a formal presence.
Oh, environmental grant makers. I do not know of any. I don't know about any of our sister organizations. We certainly have not been to EGA. Anybody else want to talk about that? But of course, SEJ, Beth Carr.
Oh, the we, that's right.
Yeah, this is, it's kind of weird because I'm a board member here, but I'm also, Beth was fortunate enough to make contact with the Environmental Grant Makers Association on behalf of SEJ, and I think organizations like SEJ, there's no organization like us, but this organization has really been a lifeline for so many environmental reporters as we've gotten shown the door. It's been really incredibly valuable. I can't say enough about SEJ. Anybody else want to take on any of that? No. Okay. Next question.
Hi, I'm Matthew Daly from the AP, and I work in Washington, and I've been reading the High Country News for years, but online, and so it's been very enjoyable to read it in print, you know, this week. And I guess I wanted to talk to you briefly about how you sort of see those missions, you know, how the magazine, which obviously has a different kind of entity versus the online site, and how you balance those, and, you know, are you ultimately going to have to choose?
I hope we don't ever have to choose. We still get a tremendous amount of feedback from readers that say, don't ever get rid of the hard copy magazine. We don't want to read this online. And part of that might tend to be our demographic. We do tend to have an older readership. But, you know, even that said, I still don't see print magazines going away anytime soon. You know, I feel like there's still very much a place for that.
But then, I mean, I guess to keep it vital, you also want to keep your website. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess you talk a little about that.
Yeah, the website historically has been basically the print magazine content plus a little bit of supplementary material. We'll put on, and we'll try to do something low budget in multimedia that we can supplement a story with. We can take, if we have a photographer that went out and we've got a lot of extra really great photos, we can take those and make a slideshow and do some narration with them. You know, or we can do a podcast, or, you know, an interview with the author of the story, or something like that. And then we also have our blogs, of course. And you know, we've experimented at various times with trying to do more on the website of what a website is good at, which is, you know, kind of shallow and fast content. You know, keeping up more with, you know, the newsy stuff. Whereas a magazine, we only come out 22 times a year, so we're not able to really address news so much in that, you know, we tend to, our stories by nature tend to be more evergreen. So we're we don't have the budget right now to do a whole lot more with the website. You know, it desperately needs a redesign, you know, with the idea that more and more people aren't coming to a homepage. They're finding your content from lots of different angles and from social media sources and from search engines. And so how do we better fit that kind of a use model rather than the idea that everybody's going to just go to hcn.org and dive down from there? So we're something that we're trying to figure out. We've actually hired an online editor who's going to be starting with us shortly, who is the first person we've had in many, many years whose sole responsibility is the website. And so we'll be really looking to them to take some leadership there and figure out what directions we really need to be going with our site. You know, and one thing that we are really trying to figure out also is, which, you know, every news outlet is struggling with, is how much content do we make available for free versus how much do we require a subscription for? You know, trying to figure that out because, you know, obviously it costs us a lot to produce this stuff and we can't just, you know, give it all away. But there's that constant tension between making stuff freely available so that it can be linked to and found by search engines and, you know, other bloggers can point people to it versus, you know, trying to figure out how we can actually, you know, recoup some of our investment in that. And that's, yeah, something that we are going to be working very hard on figuring out over the next year.
And the other, another thing that HCN's done is you have a person who does social media, right?
Yes, we do. We have a half-time person who's a contractor with us, and actually the person who's now going to be our full-time editor on this, but she has been our social, she's been doing our Twitter feed and our Facebook page and, you know, trying to just, you know, get our, you know, link to our stories from as many places in the web as she can, you know, where she sees a discussion of something relevant, kind of, you know, comment and, you know, refer people back to our stories. So she's been working very hard at getting us a kind of a presence in social media, and it's really been amazing to watch that grow. You know, we have, I think we have getting close to 3,000 followers now on Twitter and roughly a couple thousand on Facebook, I think, and so it's been another exciting way to connect with readers and, you know, kind of have a dialogue with them and strengthen that sense of reader community, which is so vital to what we do.
Okay, folks, we've got 20 minutes, so let's move. Matthew?
Sorry, I'm a follower. I just want to quickly, just the second half of that question, I guess, is if any of the other organizations are thinking about trying to have a print side or you're going to stay online.
Well, obviously, print publication is very expensive, so we don't envision doing that. And but that's why we're reaching out to print media,
right,
and hoping that we can provide our stories to them. And I mean, I'm a print person, have been for my entire career, so I certainly don't want to write off newspapers and magazines. So that's been one of my overriding goals, is to do that.
Yeah, thanks. My name is Jason Mark. I'm the editor of a quarterly environmental magazine called Earth Island Journal, published by the NGO Earth Island Institute for the last 25 years. My question's really for Marla. I love your guys' sites. I check out Daily Climate, well, daily.
And
that's good. I guess my question is, how long can you guys, or do you have any plans to monetize your websites and start asking for subscribers and donations or reader support, and are you getting pressure from foundations to do that? I mean, are the foundations giving you unconditional support and saying we just love what you do, or are they asking you to create a revenue stream?
As far as I know, none of our funders have asked that. It's something we, Douglas and I especially, debate every day. It's like, if we offer something to free for free, does then it have a real value? I mean, are we turning off people by saying, hey, it's free, and then they think, well,
right,
you know, what kind of, what are they trying to do to us here? So we've gone back and forth on that. And when I first came on board, we talked about advertising, and I just wanted to hold the line at that. I mean, we don't need it right at this point. Of course, we could expand probably if we did, but so far we're still offering everything for free, and we still have no advertising.
Can I ask this a follow-up question? So you thought about then, charging the outlets that you're working with. So, example, we've done two stories with SpotUs. And the SpotUs model, we're putting up half the money to get an exclusive right to the story, and then their,
right,
you know, their supporters are putting the other half of the money. So have you guys thought about...
Yeah, I mean, and we've considered that, and I've just thought, trying to weigh it, it's like, well, because I know newspaper budgets are really hurting right now. Will we turn off a newspaper, just add another obstacle if we make them pay? Like, well, with that cheese plant story, I hired a very good photographer, and it's expensive. You know, it was like 2 days worth of work, and so it's a lot of money. And I thought, well, couldn't the newspapers at least pay for that photographer? But I didn't go there because I just really wanted to get the stories out there. That's really my mission, and the mission of our publisher and the mission of our funders is to spread the word, cover environmental health issues that are going uncovered. So I'm just hoping we never really have to go there. I mean, would it have been worth it for that $500 or whatever I got from the Chronicle for that, you know, photo? I don't think it would have been. Great. So they got great stuff for free.
Investigate West charges. We decided that one of the big mistakes newspapers had made was to give everything away for free. So our basic model, although we've done Spot Us, we've also done the Spot Us model, but by and large we charge on a sliding scale. We hope to make that a bigger part of our revenue as time goes forward. Anybody else? You said you pay, so but you distribute your content for free?
Yes, free, although we are thinking of doing some kind of a print format. All of that's far down the line.
Cool. Next question.
Yeah, I was just going to say a little bit about academia syndication. We have a couple of different syndication services. We syndicate opinion columns every week, and then we also have we syndicate our news stories and occasionally some of our big feature stories. And the price that we charge for that is pretty nominal. I shouldn't quote exact numbers, but I think, you know, a lot of times it's a couple hundred bucks for a feature story, and like $25 for an opinion column, and again, I shouldn't quote numbers on this, but if we look at it more as a way not so much to make money. I mean, I think our syndication kind of breaks even, but just a way to help fulfill our mission of informing people and getting those stories out there more broadly, and, you know, also getting our own name out there more, you know, raising awareness of High Country News itself as a source. But we do. We have probably 70 different outlets that syndicate our stuff.
Cool. Cassandra?
Thanks. I'm Cassandra Brooks, and I am right now working with a small group of people to start a news organization dedicated to covering fisheries and oceans issues. And so the biggest obstacle I'm running into now is when I actually did the numbers yesterday of how much I would need every year to run this site. It's like $500,000, and I have about $30,000 to start it with. And so in the last few months, I've done nothing but write grants. And we are not a 501c3, but we have a fiscal sponsor who is, and we bring in money right now through private donations, fellowships, and grants. So my question is, how do you get initial access to large foundations, and how do you keep that access, and do you have a dedicated staff person that is constantly writing grants and keeping those relationships going?
So the question is about how you establish relationships with foundations. Anybody want to take that on?
Yeah, we have a dedicated development director, and she has an assistant too. And our publisher also spends a huge amount of time working on development. So, and it takes a lot of time and energy to do that fundraising. And I wish she was here to kind of speak more to how those relationships with those big foundations got developed initially. But we've had several different large foundations that we've been working with for many, many years. And yet, you know, it's still a constant effort to try to identify new foundations that might want to fund us. And, you know, foundations maybe will fund us for a few years and then say, okay, you know, it's time for you to go find somebody else to play for a while. So it's just always a struggle to try to identify those foundations. And it seems to be very much about the relationships that are built, you know, between us and the people running those foundations. And, you know, a lot of times the continuance of funding might depend on who's there at a foundation. And a person leaves that we've had a relationship with, and then the new person comes in, the priorities are slightly different, and we don't get funded anymore. So I don't really have any good suggestions, but it's really tough.
And Beth Park left, but her advice about foundations is, if you've seen one foundation, you've seen one foundation. They're pretty idiosyncratic. So. Anybody else?
What I'm learning is that there's really nothing wrong with the cold call. That hasn't hurt me at all yet. And I've also learned that it's way better to deal with someone's if they have a PR person, because they're more open to getting the name of that foundation out than pretty much anybody else in that company or in that foundation, I should say.
And my situation is probably highly unusual, but I'm not involved in funding at all. We have a publisher who does amazing things, and it's a mystery to me how he gets the funders. And I just cross my fingers every year, and he comes through. I have no idea how he does it, so I can't even offer any advice. He actually keeps, you know, kind of a firewall between me and the funders, so I can't even. People say, "Well, who are your funders?" Well, I go, "It's like about 10 different foundations, and I can't even name them." So. And just to keep that independence.
And that is Pete Myers, who is an SEJ member. Joe?
Hi, I'm Joe Davis. I work for SEJ, but I'm on my own hook here. The fact that we're having this session, I don't know if we've ever had these before, but maybe that's the answer to my question. But my question is there an issue of legitimacy for nonprofit media? And I already heard some of you say, not really, but you're all exceptions and you're all excellent exceptions. And so I wonder if nonprofit media generally aren't still struggling with this. And I also heard one of you talk about some crusty old newspaper guy, that there really is a cultural divide. And is there a legitimacy issue, and does it have to do with journalistic values? And then I'm going to ask provocatively, and who's doing better, the traditional for-profit media that aren't making a profit, or the non-profit media, in really meeting the values of journalism? Okay, that's all.
Well, I think there is a legitimacy issue, but it's to my surprise, it's not about journalistic values. I don't really have anybody questioning that. It's just, like I said, it's just more of a kind of a bureaucratic thing in the traditional media of not knowing what to accept or how to use it, or because it is so new. I mean, it's a whole new business model. It's only a few years old. But I see improvements all the time. And so it gives me hope. And I also think that more foundations will realize what's happening to traditional media and realize that they can fill the void with funding people like us.
Well, I would just sort of ask, has this changed in the last 5 years? Would it have been different 5 years ago?
Yeah, I think, you know, nobody would have thought any, you know, foundation-funded journalism, what's that, 5 years ago? And, you know, we have to credit ProPublica with a lot of that. But it's not just them anymore. You know, I don't know if anybody's ever added up the funding for all the nonprofit journalism, but it's grown quite a bit, and I think it's grown in value and grown in credibility too. Definitely over the last few years.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I think that, yeah, I think legitimacy of nonprofit news organizations is kind of a question at this point, and you know, for High Country News, I feel like we kind of established our credibility really in the 80s when it was founded. It was very much an environmentalist newspaper. It was, you know, always taking kind of the side of environmentalists. And in the 80s, it was taken over by Ed and Betsy Marston, who were New York broadcast journalists that had moved to Paoni, Colorado, where the organization is still headquartered. They had come there in the 70s and started a local newspaper. And then they were selected to run High Country News when the editors at that time, back in, I think it was 83, had decided to move on. So when Ed and Betsy Marston took over High Country News, they began kind of taking a really critical look at the West and at particular kind of like sacred cow issues like ranching. And they started examining ranching and grazing practices very closely and kind of came to the conclusion that actually ranchers could be very good stewards of the land, and that grazing could actually be beneficial if practiced well. And that really rubbed a lot of environmentalists the wrong way, who really want to see all grazing ended on public lands. And so when High Country News kind of took that step of like taking a stance that was counter to the interests of environmental groups, I think that's when it kind of came into its own of, you know, being an independent voice and, you know, being willing to look very critically at both sides of an issue. And, you know, in regards to other nonprofit outlets, you know, we consider a collaboration, and we're still kind of dabbling our toes in the water about, you know, how we're going to collaborate. We've done a little bit of stuff with Daily Climate and with WildFile, but we're still trying to kind of feel our way through collaboration and, you know, what that means to us and how we want to work that. But, you know, it's something that we always think about in regards to organizations as well. Who are their funders, and, you know, what is their agenda? And, you know, those are always things that, you know, need to be answered with any nonprofit.
I mean, what we do with our stories right now is pretty much after the fact. ProPublica works in advance, and I've been thinking about how we can work in advance to target a particular newspaper or magazine and say, okay, we're working on this story, are you interested? Instead of going after the fact, like I know that Douglas Daily Climate mm-hmm. did with High Country News. Because then you can sort of more tailor make the story mm-hmm. to that
yeah,
audience.
Alyssa.
Yeah, hi. I'm Alyssa Rosen with Pew Environment Group. And on the issue of funding for journalists in the last few years and all the changes that have happened there, we've been having conversations a little bit in the hallway about some of the changes that people are seeing in general. And one of the issues that I'm interested in is we do outreach and we're talking to reporters about an issue, a campaign issue that we have, say, in the boreal forests or, and you know, on mining issues in the West. And when we have a place or we have something that we think is a good issue to investigate, we're working with people who don't have budgets. And sometimes we'll get requests for this. And years ago, we didn't get requests from folks who are actually at some of the bigger coastal papers. That's mm-hmm. changing. We're noticing that people who are working yeah. freelance are in a different position than they used to be as well with budgets because of some of the, you know, what you're alluding to where the money is not available. So I'm wondering about, as you're working and bringing in freelancers, how you're thinking about this, if they are saying, well, yeah, the newspaper isn't going to pay for the photographer to come to the dairy, but such and such charitable organization that has a, you know, their cause is all about health and safety, you know, on the dairy or water quality, wants to pay, you know, wants to have a place to get, what do we all do about that? Is that, how do you guys feel about that?
Well, I haven't had to address that yet, and it makes me very nervous to think about story-specific funding. I mean, what I like right now about our operation is there's absolutely no strings attached. I don't even know what the mission statements are of our grant makers, and they're all very broad and really seem to not have much to do with what I write about. And so there's none of that pressure at all to do a specific story because of a funder. Eventually, maybe we will have to open up, but at this point, so far, I haven't. But it does make me very nervous.
Yeah, and the situation that you're talking about, I mean, it would make me nervous just because of, you know, even if we knew that there, you know, internally we knew there was no conflict of interest or no influence, there's still
perception.
And that's what you really have to be leery of is, you know, does it look like there was some influence? And, you know, we get foundation grants that are for very broad areas of coverage like Colorado Plateau or water issues or New Mexico, but that's as far as it goes with those foundations. You know, we make it very clear that there is no influence. You know, they don't even suggest to us what to cover or how to cover it. And we've been talking about this a lot lately because we've had some funders, individual donors it turns out that we already had a story in the works that they were very interested in funding, but we're really, really hesitant to give credit to an individual, you know, acknowledge an individual at the end of a story. You know, this story was funded by so-and-so. You know, we're really trying very hard to funnel that individual support into our general, you know, research fund or our investigative journalism fund or, you know, some big pools, just to make sure that there is no perception that people are, you know, people or organizations are paying for or influencing coverage in any way.
Yeah, I mean, we don't even have broad from funders like I'm interested in water quality or anything like that. We don't even have broad ones. So I know we're very lucky in that.
And then if the freelancers had access to a source of support that was a general fund.
I'm going to cut you off because we're not going to get to the spells question if we don't. I'm sorry to do that. But can she finish?
Let her finish.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So as the freelancers have sources of support from, say, a foundation that's there to support their work to actually get out and do investigative pieces in general, you would be willing to work with them?
That if the freelancers had their own support?
If they had their own support from an NGO that was about supporting journalistic investigation. Mm.
No, I don't think I would, actually, but you would have to look at a case-by-case basis.
Hi, I'm Matt Connolly. I'm a student at Northwestern University, and I edit for North by Northwestern, which is an online news magazine we update daily, and then a magazine that we publish quarterly. We incorporated last year as a not-for-profit 501c3, and we have kind of an advantage in that no one gets paid, so we don't have to worry about that.
That would make it easier.
But I was wondering if you, two quick things. If you know of any grants or foundations that are interested in student journalism, and what kind of tips you have for students who are looking for a grant or foundation and trying to legitimize themselves to a group that's normally used to funding and professional publications like that.
I would go look at who's funding the Student Press Law Center, among others. Trying to think of where else you might find that sort of. But I would go get their 990, their Form 990 from the IRS, and find out who their funders are at the Student Press Law Center. Any other thoughts?
I would love to have an answer to that too. The student journalism and some funding, I'd love to work with them. I have an intern program right now. It's something that I brought on, and we don't have any funding for it, so I just sort of work it into my budget. We have interns from Michigan State and from NYU, and we pay them for stories and pay them for aggregation. And I'd love to work with other universities. I mean, we like those two because they're master's students. We really don't have the staff to work with undergrads. So, but if there's other college programs out there that are looking for paid internships, and I would think there would be, that we'd love to work with them.
Yeah, Magazine News has had an internship program basically for its entire existence. So at this point, we've had 250 some interns come through the program.
That's great.
And we have. We, a couple of years ago, had a pretty big fundraising campaign to create an endowment for the internship program, but we're going to run through that at the end of this year, and then we'll have to tackle it again. But we don't have particular foundations that we approach for funding the internship program, because I guess we don't know of any, so we've been...
That would be great.
Yeah, it would be great.
Unfunded for us at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we rely on our individual donors to fund our internship program. But it's a... If anybody wants more details about the internship program, if you know a promising young journalist who would benefit from 6 months of training, come talk to me.
Okay, we're going to squeeze in one more question from Amelia.
Hi, Amelia Scarry, University of Michigan. Is there any response to this? I happen to be, as a student in this master's program I'm in at the School of Information, working with a client who wants to start an international student news network. And this would not be a funding for internships, but would be some kind of recognition and a bigger platform and perhaps some scholarships for the best stories produced by students in this network. So anyone who's interested in talking further about that, this is a large company, a textbook and database company that has international reach already, and so I'm interested in talking to anybody.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up there. If you want to know more, there is an article in the News Pro about some of these kinds of efforts that are going on. So, thanks for coming.